There will come a moment in your life, quiet, unannounced, uncomfortable, when you realize that the real problem was never loneliness. It was dependence. Dependence on noise. Dependence on approval. Dependence on people to tell you who you are, what you're worth, and whether you're doing enough. And the moment that support disappears, even briefly, everything inside you begins to shake. Most people don't collapse because they are weak. They collapse because they were never alone long enough to become strong. We live in a world that treats solitude like a disease and distraction like medicine, a world that teaches you to stay visible, stay connected, stay stimulated, not because it makes you wiser, but because silence exposes what most people are desperately avoiding. Silence removes the mask. Silence removes the audience. Silence removes the excuse. And when there is no one left to impress, you finally meet yourself. This is where most people panic. They reach for their phone. They reach for company. They reach for noise. Because being alone forces a confrontation that cannot be negotiated. The confrontation with who you are when nothing is distracting you, validating you, or soothing you. Solitude is not punishment, it is training. It is the environment where false confidence collapses, where borrowed beliefs lose their grip, where emotional dependence is exposed, and where the parts of you that cannot survive noise are finally given space to grow. Nothing meaningful is built in constant stimulation. No inner authority is forged in crowds. No self-mastery is developed while you are constantly being regulated from the outside. Staying alone is not about rejecting people. It is about reclaiming yourself. It is about withdrawing, not in bitterness, but in discipline, long enough to detox from validation, reset your nervous system, confront your shadow, rebuild your values, and construct an inner world that does not collapse the moment the world looks away. Because the most dangerous individual is not the loudest, not the most admired, not the most surrounded. It is the one who can stand calmly, clearly, and completely on their own. Stay alone until you no longer need to be. 1. The validation detox. At some point, and this moment is unavoidable, you have to confront a question that most people spend their entire lives avoiding. Who are you when no one is watching? Not when you are praised. Not when you are supported. Not when your effort is noticed, rewarded, or approved. But when there is no audience at all, when your actions echo into silence and return nothing back to you. This is where most people stop. They don't quit because the path is hard. They quit because the reward disappears. What drives them was never conviction. It was applause, validation, the subtle reassurance that someone, somewhere, is confirming their existence. And when that confirmation fades, their discipline collapses, their motivation evaporates, and their sense of self begins to tremble. This is not accidental. It is conditioning. From early on, you were trained to associate worth with response. Approval meant safety. Praise meant value. Being seen meant being real. Over time, this created a dangerous dependency, not on people themselves, but on their reactions. You learned to move when rewarded, to stop when ignored, and to doubt yourself the moment feedback disappeared. This is why solitude feels threatening, because solitude removes the mirror. When you are alone, there is no reflection telling you who you are supposed to be, no emotional reward for effort. No reassurance that you are on the right path. And in that absence, a quiet panic begins to surface. The urge to check. The urge to be seen. The urge to announce progress instead of making it. This urge is addiction. Epictetus warned that improvement requires being content with being thought foolish or irrelevant, because the moment you stop needing to be admired, you regain control over your direction. As long as approval is your fuel, your path is not yours. It bends with opinions. It sways with neglect. It collapses under criticism. A person addicted to validation lives in permanent tension, Praise inflates them, silence unsettles them, criticism wounds them far beyond reason. Their confidence is not rooted, it is rented, and anything rented can be taken away. Solitude begins the detox. When you stay alone long enough, something uncomfortable but necessary happens. You work and no one notices. You improve and no one congratulates you. You struggle and no one comforts you. At first, this feels empty, almost pointless. But what is actually happening is a rewiring. Your mind is learning to act without reward. Slowly, your sense of self stops reaching outward. You begin to act because it aligns with your standards. To continue because you respect your own word. To persist without needing proof that anyone cares. This is where real discipline is born. Not loud, not performative, not dependent on motivation, but quiet, private, and stable. You stop explaining yourself. You stop announcing progress. You stop chasing recognition. And in that silence, self-respect replaces validation. A man who needs approval is easy to control. Guide him with praise, punish him with neglect. But a man who has detoxed from validation becomes unpredictable in the best possible way. He cannot be bought with compliments or broken by criticism. His center is internal. This is why the journey begins here. Before solitude gives you clarity, before it gives you strength, before it gives you authority, it strips you of your addiction to being seen. Do the work quietly, improve without witnesses. Let your discipline become private, because when validation is no longer your fuel, nothing outside of you can dictate your direction. 2. The biological reset. What most people call anxiety, restlessness, or lack of focus is not a mystery of the soul. It is exhaustion of the nervous system. Your mind is not weak. It is overstimulated. It has been trained day after day to expect constant reward, constant novelty, constant stimulation until silence no longer feels peaceful. It feels threatening. This is not a character flaw. It is biology. Your brain is governed by dopamine, the chemical of pursuit, anticipation, and reward. It was never designed for endless scrolling, constant entertainment, or pleasure without effort. Dopamine was meant to rise when you worked, struggled, moved forward, and then fall back to baseline so calm could return. But modern life keeps it elevated permanently, and when the baseline rises, peace feels empty, simplicity feels boring, and stillness feels unbearable. This is why people cannot sit alone in a room without reaching for something. Not because they are curious, but because their nervous system is starving for stimulation. Solitude interrupts this cycle, brutally at first. When you remove noise, screens, social feedback, and constant novelty, your brain reacts like an addict cut off from supply. Thoughts race. The body feels uneasy. Boredom feels heavy. You begin searching for escape, not because something is wrong, but because your nervous system is recalibrating. Most people mistake this discomfort for proof that solitude is unhealthy. In reality, it is proof that it is working. As the days pass, something subtle begins to happen. The dopamine baseline starts to drop. Silence becomes tolerable. Then neutral, then calming. Simple things regain weight. Reading no longer feels dull. Walking becomes grounding. Thinking slows down. Your attention, once scattered, begins to return. Seneca understood this long before neuroscience gave it a name. When he said that poverty is not having too little but craving more, he was pointing to this exact mechanism. Craving is not a desire, it is a dependency. And dependency is always a form of slavery. Solitude starves the craving. You stop feeding the need for constant pleasure. And in doing so, you regain sensitivity. Your mind no longer demands stimulation to feel alive. You become capable of calm without distraction. Contentment without excess. Focus without pressure. This is why serious disciplines, philosophers, monks, warriors, always included solitude. Not for mysticism, for regulation. A calm nervous system is not softness, it is an advantage. A mind that does not require constant reward can endure discomfort, delay gratification, and choose long-term clarity over short-term relief. A man enslaved to pleasure is easy to distract. A man at peace with simplicity is difficult to control. This biological reset is the hidden foundation of self-mastery. Without it, discipline feels forced, focus feels fragile, silence feels threatening. But once the reset occurs, effort becomes natural, stillness becomes safe, and peace stops feeling like deprivation. You are no longer chasing stimulation, you are grounded in yourself, and from that ground, true mastery begins. 3. Confronting the shadow. There is a reason silence unsettles you more than chaos, and it has nothing to do with boredom. Silence is feared because it removes distraction, and when distraction disappears, what rises is not peace, but truth. The thoughts you avoided, the impulses you buried, the emotions you learned to suppress to remain acceptable, all of them surface when there is nowhere left to run. In solitude, you are no longer protected by roles, routines, or reactions. You are left alone with the parts of yourself you never learned how to face. You cannot master what you refuse to acknowledge. Around others, it is easy to perform strength, confidence, morality, and calm. You learn early which traits are rewarded and which are punished, and slowly you split yourself in two, the self you show and the self you hide. What you hide does not disappear. It waits. It gathers energy. And when it is denied awareness, it expresses itself unconsciously at the worst possible moments. This is why people sabotage themselves when things begin to work, why they explode emotionally when composure is required, why they repeat patterns they swear they want to escape. The shadow always collects its debt. Carl Jung called this hidden territory the shadow, the rejected parts of your personality that you disowned, not because they were evil, but because they threatened the image you wanted to maintain. Fear, envy, resentment, aggression, the desire for control, the hunger for recognition, none of these vanish when ignored. They simply move underground. And from there, they pull the strings. Solitude is where this dynamic becomes visible. When you stay alone long enough without noise or validation, patterns begin to reveal themselves. You notice how much of your confidence is performative, how often your decisions are driven by fear rather than clarity, how quickly your morals bend when comfort is at risk. This realization is uncomfortable, but it is also liberating, because what is conscious can be directed. Most people turn back here. They re-enter noise, they distract themselves, they label introspection as overthinking. Not because they found peace, but because the confrontation was destabilizing. Yet the shadow does not disappear when avoided. It waits patiently for stress, fatigue, or temptation, moments when control is weakest. Mastery demands the opposite response. Instead of condemning your darkness, you study it. Instead of suppressing impulses, you trace their origin. You stop asking, "Why shouldn't I feel this?" and start asking, "What is this trying to tell me?" Because every dark trait carries energy. Aggression becomes assertiveness when disciplined. Fear becomes discernment. Envy becomes information. The shadow is not your enemy, it is power without direction. Jung was precise here. Enlightenment is not achieved by imagining yourself as pure or endlessly positive. It comes from making the darkness conscious, from integrating it into your identity so it no longer hijacks your behavior from the shadows. The goal is not to eliminate the shadow, but to bring it under command. A man who has not faced his shadow is fragile, no matter how moral he appears. He is reactive, unpredictable, and easily manipulated by blind spots he refuses to see. But a man who has confronted his darkness, understood it, and integrated it becomes grounded in a different way. He is no longer shocked by himself. He is no longer afraid of his own depth. This is where inner authority is forged, not in pretending to be good, but in knowing exactly what you are capable of, and choosing consciously, again and again, who you will be. Solitude reveals the shadow. Courage integrates it. And integration is what turns inner chaos into controlled power. 4. Sovereign decision making. Most people believe they make decisions, but what they really do is negotiate with fear until someone else relieves them of responsibility. They ask, they poll, they wait, they hesitate, not because they are thoughtful, but because standing alone with a choice feels dangerous. Consensus becomes anesthesia. Agreement becomes permission. And slowly, without noticing, their ability to decide atrophies. The crowd has always been louder than truth. When you live surrounded by voices, opinions begin to feel like facts. Repetition starts to sound like certainty. Popularity disguises itself as correctness, and because the noise never stops, you lose the quiet necessary to hear your own reasoning. You begin adjusting choices not according to what is right, but according to what will be accepted. Over time, you stop asking, "Is this aligned?" and start asking, "Will this be approved?" This is how sovereignty erodes, politely, invisibly, without resistance. Solitude interrupts this pattern at the root. When you are alone, there is no one to consult, no emotional shield to hide behind, no shared blame if the outcome disappoints. The decision returns to its rightful owner. At first, this feels unsettling, even frightening, because responsibility is heavy when it is no longer diluted by advice and reassurance. You feel the full weight of consequence. There is no one to soften it for you. But this pressure is not destructive, it is clarifying. Alone, you are forced to slow down. You stop reacting and begin reasoning. You learn to distinguish impulse from intuition, fear from caution, urgency from necessity. You notice how often you once asked for opinions, not because others knew better, but because their agreement made you feel safe. Safety, however, has never been the same as truth. This is where thinking from first principles returns. You begin to ask yourself different questions, quieter questions, heavier questions. What do I know to be true, even if no one agrees? What choice can I live with if it fails? What decision reflects my values, not my anxiety? These questions don't offer immediate comfort, but they offer clarity. And clarity is more durable than reassurance. Friedrich Nietzsche understood this cost when he wrote about the individual's struggle against the tribe. The tribe offers belonging, certainty, and protection, but only if you agree not to think too far beyond its boundaries. It will celebrate you when you conform and isolate you when you don't. If you insist on owning your decisions, loneliness is not a punishment. It is the toll. In solitude, something subtle but decisive happens. Your internal compass strengthens. You stop measuring choices by applause and start measuring them by alignment. Decisions cease to be performances and become commitments. You act not because you are guaranteed success, but because you are clear about direction. You accept uncertainty without outsourcing courage. This is sovereign decision-making. It does not mean you are always right. It means you are accountable. When a choice fails, you study it instead of deflecting blame. When it succeeds, the confidence that follows is grounded because it was earned through self-trust, not borrowed reassurance. You learn faster because you own the outcome. You mature quicker because you don't hide from consequence. A person who cannot decide alone will never be free in company. They will bend to pressure, delay under scrutiny, and wait for permission disguised as advice. Their life will be shaped by the loudest voice in the room. But a person who has learned to sit with uncertainty, to choose without consensus, and to stand by their reasoning even when misunderstood, becomes internally ungovernable. Notice the shift that occurs when this capacity returns. You stop over-explaining. You stop rehearsing justifications. You stop needing to convince others before you move. You listen, but you don't surrender authorship. You learn, but you don't dissolve your judgment. You can change your mind without collapsing your identity. Solitude trains this muscle daily. Every quiet hour where you decide what to do with your time without external prompts, every difficult choice you make without announcing it, every moment you resist the urge to ask for permission, these are repetitions. Over time, decisiveness becomes natural, not rushed, not aggressive, calm, precise, unapologetic. This is not arrogance, it is ownership. When you reclaim the ability to decide from within, life stops feeling reactive. You no longer drift between options shaped by pressure and fear. You move with intent, and intent compounds. Paths clarify. Energy consolidates. You stop wasting strength negotiating with opinions that were never yours to begin with. Solitude is not isolation here. It is the forge of authority. And once authority is internal, the world loses its power to pull you in 100 conflicting directions. You may still listen, you may still consider, but you decide. And that single fact changes everything. 5. Emotional autonomy. Most people believe they are emotionally mature simply because they have learned how to manage appearances, how to stay calm in public, how to smile when expected, how to suppress reactions long enough to seem composed. But emotional autonomy has nothing to do with looking stable. It has everything to do with not needing another person to regulate what is happening inside you. And this is where most adults quietly fail. They depend on others to soothe their anxiety, to validate their pain, to stabilize their moods, to reassure them that everything is okay. When they feel unsettled, they reach outward. When they feel hurt, they wait to be comforted. When they feel empty, they expect connection to fill the gap. And when no one shows up, when the text doesn't come, when the support fades, when attention is withdrawn, their inner world collapses into resentment, confusion, or panic. This is not intimacy. This is emotional dependency. A child needs another nervous system to calm them. That is natural. That is survival. But an adult who never learned to self-regulate remains psychologically unfinished. They may function well when supported, but crumble when alone. They may feel strong in connection, but fragile in silence. Their emotional stability is conditional, dependent on others behaving correctly. Solitude exposes this dependency without mercy. When you are alone, there is no external regulator, no one to distract you from discomfort, no one to absorb your emotional overflow. Whatever arises, anxiety, sadness, anger, emptiness, must be faced directly. At first, this feels overwhelming, almost unfair, because the mind has been trained to expect relief from the outside. But this discomfort is not harm, it is training. In solitude, you begin to discover something essential. Emotions are not emergencies. They rise, they intensify, and they fall, even when you do nothing to fix them. You learn that anxiety does not require escape. Sadness does not require saving. And anger does not require expression. You can sit with feeling without becoming it. You can experience emotion without surrendering control. This is the moment where power quietly returns. Aristotle understood this when he said that happiness belongs to the self-sufficient, not because others are unimportant, but because dependence makes peace fragile. If your inner balance requires someone else to stay, respond, approve, or reassure, then your peace is never truly yours. Solitude retrains your emotional system. You learn how to calm yourself without numbing, how to process pain without broadcasting it, how to feel deeply without leaking energy through complaint. And something profound happens when you stop expecting others to fix what is happening inside you. Your relationships change. You stop clinging. You stop demanding emotional labor. You stop using closeness as anesthesia. Connection becomes lighter, cleaner, voluntary. You choose people instead of needing them. An emotionally dependent person is easy to control through attention, withdrawal, praise, or silence. Their mood is always hostage to circumstances, but an emotionally autonomous person becomes difficult to destabilize. Their center is internal, their calm is practiced, their reactions are measured. This is not coldness, this is adulthood. When you master your inner climate, the outside world loses its authority over your peace. People can disappoint you without destroying you. Rejection no longer feels like annihilation. Silence no longer feels like abandonment. You remain grounded, not because life is gentle, but because you are no longer fragile. Emotional autonomy is not about feeling less. It is about being ruled less. And without this mastery, solitude turns into isolation. With it, solitude becomes strength. 6. The Architect of Values. Most people believe they live by values, but what they actually live by are habits they never questioned, beliefs they absorbed through repetition, and rules they obey out of fear of standing alone. Their morality feels familiar, comfortable, and obvious. Not because it is true, but because it was inherited. And what is inherited is rarely examined. It is simply obeyed. This is how a life is lived without authorship. When you never stop to define what matters to you, the world gladly does it for you. Culture hands you priorities. Family hands you expectations. Society hands you definitions of success, failure, love, and worth. And because these definitions arrive early and loudly, most people mistake them for their own. They defend them. They suffer for them. They feel guilty when they violate them, even though they never consciously agreed to them. Solitude is where this quiet theft is exposed. When you are alone long enough, the borrowed noise begins to fade. There is no social reward for saying the right thing, no punishment for thinking differently, no audience to echo your beliefs back to you. And in that silence, a heavy realization settles in. Much of what you believe has never been chosen. It has simply been repeated. This realization is unsettling because it removes every shortcut. You can no longer hide behind ideology. You can no longer outsource morality to tradition. You can no longer say, "This is just how things are," without asking why. Alone, contradictions become impossible to ignore. You start noticing where your actions betray your stated principles, where your beliefs shift depending on who is watching, where your sense of right and wrong collapses the moment comfort or belonging is threatened. This is not a crisis. This is construction. Plato warned that the unexamined life is not worth living, not as a moral insult, but as a diagnosis. A life guided by unexamined beliefs is a life lived reactively, shaped by forces you never consciously chose. Solitude gives you the psychological space to interrupt this momentum and begin examining the foundations of your inner world. And the questions that arise here are not pleasant ones. What does success mean when status is removed from the equation, when no one is watching, when no one will applaud the outcome? What kind of suffering are you willing to endure without resentment, because it aligns with who you are? What lines will you not cross, even if breaking them would be easier, safer, more profitable? These questions demand time. They cannot be rushed, because values chosen quickly are often borrowed, while values forged slowly tend to endure. In solitude, you begin testing beliefs not against popularity, but against reality. You watch how they hold up under stress, you notice which principles remain intact when temptation appears, and which ones dissolve immediately. This is where the architect replaces the consumer. You stop collecting beliefs like accessories. You stop quoting principles you don't live by. You begin building a personal constitution, not written for admiration, but for guidance. These values are not loud. They don't need defending. They reveal themselves through consistency, through restraint, through the calm certainty with which you choose one path and abandon another without explanation. A man without self-defined values is endlessly adjustable. He shifts with pressure. He bends with opinion. He becomes whoever the environment rewards. But a man who has written his own code moves differently. He does not need to announce his principles. He does not need to justify his refusals. His decisions appear simple from the outside, but they are anchored deep within. This is why solitude is not emptiness. It is authorship. It is where you stop inheriting rules and start taking responsibility for what governs your life. It is where you accept the weight of choosing and with it, the weight of consequence. Because values only become real when they cost you something. Once your values are consciously chosen, confusion begins to fade. Not because life becomes easy, but because direction becomes clear. Temptation loses its power. Guilt loses its grip. You no longer feel pulled in 100 conflicting directions because there is an internal framework deciding for you. You may still listen to others. You may still learn, but you are no longer programmable. And when your values are yours, truly yours, the world can no longer decide who you are. Solitude didn't make you rigid. It made you rooted. And from roots, real strength grows. 7. Embracing boredom. Most people don't fear suffering. They fear emptiness. They fear the quiet moment when there is nothing demanding their attention, nothing entertaining them, nothing pulling them forward. In that moment, they reach instinctively for noise, for stimulation, for anything that fills the space. Not because the space is dangerous, but because it is unfamiliar. Boredom has been misunderstood. It is treated as a problem to be solved, a flaw in the environment, a sign that something is missing. But boredom is not a malfunction. It is a signal, a pause, a threshold. And for anyone serious about self-mastery, it is not an enemy. It is an initiation. Modern life has trained you to fear doing nothing. Every empty second is filled. Every silence is interrupted. Every pause is medicated with content. Over time, your mind forgets how to remain still without panic. Stillness begins to feel like decay. And so you stay busy, not productive, not focused, just occupied enough to avoid yourself. This constant filling is not harmless. It weakens perception. When the mind is never allowed to rest in emptiness, it loses depth. Thought becomes shallow. Attention fragments. Insight disappears. You become reactive, restless, perpetually unsatisfied. Not because life lacks meaning, but because there is no space left to perceive it. Solitude restores that space. When you are alone and the stimulation is removed, boredom appears almost immediately. The urge to escape arises. The body feels unsettled. The mind searches for something, anything, to latch onto. Most people interpret this discomfort as proof that something is wrong. In truth, something essential is beginning. If you stay, if you do not escape, boredom changes character. At first, it is noisy. Then it becomes quiet. Then it becomes fertile. This is the moment most people never reach. Blaise Pascal observed that many of humanity's problems stem from the inability to sit quietly alone in a room. He wasn't talking about laziness. He was pointing to a deeper incapacity, the inability to face unstructured awareness without fleeing. Because when the noise stops, the mind is forced to encounter itself without filters. In boredom, the false urgency dissolves. You stop reacting to every impulse. You stop chasing novelty for its own sake. Your nervous system slows down, and as it does, Perception sharpens. Ideas surface that were drowned out by noise. Questions you avoided begin to form. Patterns become visible. The mind starts connecting dots, not because it is stimulated, but because it is finally unoccupied. This is where insight lives, not in frenzy, not in constant motion, but in the quiet space boredom creates. Creativity, clarity, and deep understanding are not produced by stimulation. They emerge from stillness. Boredom is the doorway through which the deeper layers of the mind speak. When you interrupt it too quickly, you silence that voice. When you stay with it, patiently, it begins to reveal what distraction was hiding. There is another layer to boredom that matters even more. Boredom teaches restraint. When you stop filling every silence, you begin to notice how often you act not out of intention, but out of discomfort. You speak to avoid awkwardness. You scroll to avoid thinking. You consume to avoid feeling. Boredom exposes these reflexes and, over time, weakens them. You regain choice. You learn that you don't need to respond to every impulse. You don't need to escape every pause. You don't need to fill every moment to feel alive. This changes how you move through the world. A person who cannot tolerate boredom is easy to manipulate. Give them stimulation and you own their attention. Remove it and they panic. But a person who has learned to sit with emptiness becomes internally free. Their focus is not fragile. Their peace is not dependent on constant input. They can wait, they can listen, they can think. This is why boredom is not laziness. It is discipline without movement. It is the training ground of patience, depth, and self-command. It teaches you that meaning is not something you consume. It is something that reveals itself when you stop interfering. Solitude makes boredom unavoidable. Mastery makes it valuable. When you stop fearing emptiness, silence stops threatening you. And when silence stops threatening you, the mind begins to settle into a deeper order, one that does not need constant stimulation to feel whole. Boredom is not the absence of meaning, it is the space where meaning finally has room to appear. Stay there long enough, and you will begin to hear yourself think. 8. The skill of observation. Most people believe they see the world clearly, but what they really do is react to it. They speak before they understand. They judge before they observe. They fill every silence with words, opinions, and explanations. Not because they have something important to say, but because silence makes them uncomfortable. In constant noise, perception becomes shallow, and the truth hides in plain sight. You cannot observe deeply while you are always expressing. When you're surrounded by others, you're pulled into performance. Conversation becomes a stage. Identity becomes something you maintain in real time. Your attention turns outward, split between speaking, responding, defending, and being understood. In that state, you miss subtlety, you miss patterns, you miss what people reveal when they are not being addressed. Solitude changes this completely. When you step back from constant interaction, your mind begins to slow, the urge to respond weakens, the need to be heard fades, and in that quiet, attention sharpens. You start noticing things that were always there, but drowned out by your own noise. Shifts in tone, inconsistencies in behavior, motives beneath words. This is not detachment, it is precision. Observation requires distance. When you are emotionally entangled, perception distorts. You hear what you want to hear. You see what confirms your expectations. Solitude creates psychological space, and in that space, clarity emerges. Pythagoras advised that silence should be preferred unless words are worth more than silence itself. He understood that speech is costly. Every word spends attention, energy, and presence. When you reduce unnecessary expression, you recover something more valuable, awareness. In solitude, you begin observing not only others, but yourself. You notice your impulses before you act on them. You catch emotional reactions as they form. You see how certain environments trigger you, how certain people drain you, how certain patterns repeat. This self-observation is not judgment. It is reconnaissance. You cannot change what you do not first see. Over time, this skill extends outward. You begin reading situations instead of reacting to them. You see how people reveal priorities through behavior rather than words. You recognize manipulation, not because you are suspicious, but because you are attentive. You learn when to speak and when silence carries more power than explanation. This creates a quiet advantage. Most people are transparent when they talk too much. They reveal insecurity, intention, fear, and need without realizing it. The observer does not compete in this noise. They listen. They wait. And because they wait, they see. A person who cannot stop talking is easy to predict. A person who can observe quietly becomes difficult to read. This does not mean withdrawal from life. It means engagement with awareness rather than impulse. You still participate, but you do not drown in reaction. You act with timing instead of urgency. You respond with precision instead of emotion. Solitude trains this ability daily. Every moment spent without speaking, every situation observed without comment, every impulse resisted is a repetition. Over time, awareness becomes your default state. You no longer feel compelled to fill silence. You become comfortable letting others reveal themselves. And when you truly see, you gain choice. You choose where to invest energy. You choose which battles are worth fighting. You choose when silence is the strongest response. The skill of observation turns life from a blur into a pattern. And once you see the pattern, you are no longer trapped inside it. Silence doesn't make you passive. It makes you perceptive. And perception is power. 9. The inner citadel. Most people build their sense of safety outside themselves. They rely on routines staying intact, people behaving predictably, circumstances remaining favorable. And when any of that shifts, criticism, loss, chaos, uncertainty, their inner world collapses with it. What they called stability was never strength. It was dependency wearing the mask of control. True security is internal, or it is not security at all. Life does not become calmer as you grow. It becomes louder, faster, more volatile. Opinions multiply. Crises appear without warning. Pressure does not ask for permission. And if your peace depends on the world cooperating, you will spend your life negotiating with forces you cannot command. The Stoics understood this with brutal clarity. Marcus Aurelius spoke of the inner citadel, a mind so fortified that no external disturbance can breach it. Not because the world stops attacking, but because the walls are built inward. This citadel is not emotional numbness. It is disciplined perception. It is the ability to decide what enters your inner world and what does not. Solitude is where this fortress is constructed. When you are alone, stripped of distraction and emotional outsourcing, you begin to see how porous your inner boundaries really are. A careless comment lingers for hours. A memory hijacks your mood. A future fear drains your energy before it even exists. You realize that the enemy is not outside. It is the lack of internal structure. The inner citadel is built one decision at a time. It begins with attention. You learn to notice which thoughts deserve engagement and which are simply noise. Not every impulse needs action. Not every feeling needs expression. Not every opinion needs residence. In solitude, you practice this daily, allowing thoughts to pass without granting them authority. Then comes restraint. You stop feeding resentment with rumination. You stop rehearsing arguments that never happen. You stop reliving injuries that cannot be changed. This is not denial. It is command. You are no longer at the mercy of every mental intrusion. Gradually, emotional storms lose their force. Anger still arises, but it does not govern. Fear still appears, but it does not dictate. Sadness still visits, but it does not settle in. This is the citadel at work. Its walls are built from clarity, not avoidance, from discipline, not suppression, from acceptance of what you cannot control and ruthless focus on what you can. The mind becomes a place of refuge rather than a battlefield. Most people never build this. They leave the gates open. Every insult enters. Every crisis occupies the throne. Every opinion takes residence. Their inner world becomes crowded, noisy, unstable, and they wonder why they feel exhausted. A city without walls cannot know peace. Solitude teaches you where to build them. You begin asking sharper questions. Is this thought useful? Is this emotion instructive? Is this concern within my control? If not, it is acknowledged and released. Not resisted, not indulged, released. This practice compounds. Over time, the space between stimulus and response widens. You are no longer dragged by reaction. You choose when to engage and when to withdraw. External chaos continues, but it no longer dictates your internal order. This is not detachment from life. It is sovereignty within it. A person with an inner citadel does not need perfect conditions to remain steady. They carry their center with them. They can enter conflict without losing composure. They can endure loss without collapsing. They can face uncertainty without panic. This is why the Stoics were calm, not because life was gentle, but because their minds were fortified. The world will test you. It always does. Without an inner citadel, every test becomes a wound. With it, every test becomes proof of strength. Build your fortress quietly, reinforce it daily, guard what enters. Because when your mind becomes a place of refuge, nothing outside of it can ever make you homeless again. 10. Independence is freedom. Most people speak about freedom as if it were an idea, a feeling, or a state of mind. But freedom is not abstract. It is structural. You are not free because you think independently. You are free because you can survive independently. And wherever survival depends on others, obedience quietly follows. This is the part of philosophy that makes people uncomfortable. They enjoy ideas about inner peace, detachment, and self-mastery, but they avoid the practical truth beneath them. If you are materially, emotionally, or functionally dependent, your principles will eventually bend. Not because you are weak, but because hunger rewrites values. Fear negotiates morals. Need compromises integrity. Solitude exposes this illusion brutally. When you are alone long enough, stripped of distraction and reassurance, a hard realization emerges. Much of what you tolerate, accept, or pretend not to see is not chosen. It is endured out of dependence. You stay quiet because you need approval. You comply because you need income. You remain in environments that drain you because leaving feels dangerous. This is not freedom. This is managed captivity. True independence begins when you stop confusing philosophy with capacity. Self-mastery is meaningless if your survival depends on circumstances you cannot control, if your peace collapses the moment resources are threatened, if your courage evaporates when comfort is at risk. Solitude forces this reckoning because there is no one else to lean on, no system to hide behind, no one to blame for what you lack. And this is where responsibility returns. You begin to see independence not as isolation, but as preparation, as the deliberate building of skills, resilience, and self-reliance so that your choices are not made under pressure. You stop asking, "What can I afford to believe?" and start asking, "What must I become so that belief is no longer expensive?" This shift changes everything. You start valuing competence over image, capability over comfort. Skills over status. You begin to understand that real power is quiet and unannounced. It lives in knowing you can endure discomfort without collapsing, adapt without begging, and walk away without panic. Lao Tzu captured this truth simply when he said that mastering others may make you powerful, but mastering yourself makes you formidable. Self-mastery here does not mean emotional control alone, it means logistical freedom. The ability to say no without fear, the capacity to stand firm without needing rescue. Solitude sharpens this awareness daily. When you are alone, there is no safety net of distraction. You feel your weaknesses clearly. Financial fragility, skill gaps, emotional reliance, physical neglect. Instead of numbing this awareness, solitude demands that you respond to it. Not with self-criticism, but with construction. Independence is built, not declared. You build it by acquiring skills that make you useful beyond approval. By learning how to sustain yourself mentally when motivation fades. By training your body to endure stress. By reducing unnecessary desires so fewer things can control you. By simplifying your life until survival no longer requires constant negotiation. This is not minimalism as aesthetics. This is minimalism as leverage. The fewer things you need to function, the fewer chains can bind you. When pleasure is optional, deprivation loses power. When validation is unnecessary, manipulation fails. When comfort is not essential, fear becomes manageable. Notice how this changes your posture in the world. You stop explaining yourself excessively. You stop tolerating disrespect out of necessity. You stop staying where you are not valued, not because you are aggressive, but because you are no longer cornered. A dependent person must calculate every word. Every refusal feels risky. Every boundary feels expensive. But an independent person moves differently. Their decisions are cleaner. Their values are harder to bend. Their silence carries weight because it is not a plea. It is a choice. This is where philosophy becomes real. Not in quotes, not in ideals, but in structure. Independence gives your inner citadel a foundation. Without it, mental peace is fragile, constantly threatened by external instability. With it, your calm becomes durable. You can lose without breaking. You can wait without panicking. You can walk away without self-betrayal. Solitude is where this commitment is made, not to withdraw forever, but to build quietly until freedom is no longer a theory. Until your life is arranged in a way that allows you to live by your principles without apology. Because the ultimate test of self-mastery is simple. Can you survive without surrendering yourself? If the answer is yes, then independence is no longer a goal. It is your reality. 11. The death of FOMO. Most people believe their fear is about missing opportunities, but if you look closely, you'll see that what they truly fear is something far simpler. Being absent, not being invited, not being included, not being visible. FOMO is not about events or experiences. It is about identity insecurity. It is the quiet panic that if you are not everywhere, you might become no one. This fear keeps people scattered. They say yes when they should say no. They stay connected when they should step back. They consume information endlessly, afraid that something essential is happening without them. And in trying to be everywhere, they slowly disappear from their own lives. Solitude exposes this fear immediately. When you step away from constant interaction, the mind reacts with anxiety. Questions arise. What if I fall behind? What if I miss the moment? What if others move forward without me? This discomfort is not a warning. It is withdrawal. You are separating from a habit of external relevance that has quietly replaced internal direction. FOMO thrives in noise. The more you see, the more you compare. The more you compare, the more you feel lacking. The more you feel lacking, the harder you chase. This cycle never ends because there is always something happening somewhere. And if your sense of worth is tied to participation, you will never rest. You will never choose depth because depth requires absence from surface-level movement. Solitude breaks this illusion. When you are alone long enough, something subtle changes. The urgency fades. The constant scanning of possibilities slows. you begin to realize that most of what you feared missing was never essential to begin with. It was distraction disguised as opportunity, movement disguised as progress. Seneca captured this perfectly when he warned that to be everywhere is to be nowhere, not because movement is wrong, but because scattered attention dissolves meaning. When your energy is divided endlessly, nothing receives enough presence to grow. In solitude, you reclaim selectivity. You stop chasing every signal. You stop reacting to every invitation. You begin asking a more dangerous question. Does this actually matter? Not to your image, not to your status, but to your life. This question changes your trajectory. You begin choosing absence deliberately. You miss conversations without guilt. You skip trends without anxiety. You allow moments to pass without participation. And instead of shrinking, your inner world expands. Focus returns. Direction sharpens. You stop living horizontally, spread thin across many things, and start living vertically, deeply invested in fewer, meaningful pursuits. This is the death of FOMO. Not forced, not dramatic, quiet and decisive. You realize that missing distractions is not loss, it is gain. That silence is not emptiness, it is capacity. That depth is impossible without sacrifice. And the first sacrifice is constant availability. A person ruled by FOMO is easy to manipulate. Keep them busy, informed, invited, stimulated, and they will never question direction. But a person who has learned to miss out intentionally becomes internally free. Their time is protected, their energy is guarded, their attention is no longer for sale. Notice how your posture changes when FOMO dies. You stop explaining why you are unavailable. You stop justifying your absence. You stop apologizing for choosing yourself. You are no longer afraid of being left behind because you are finally moving towards something instead of reacting to everything. You are not slower. You are more precise. You are not disconnected. You are focused. Solitude teaches this discipline naturally. When there is no constant stream to keep up with, the mind relearns patience. It learns that life is not happening elsewhere. It is happening here, in whatever you choose to give your attention to fully. You don't need to be everywhere. You need to be somewhere on purpose. And when you understand this, the fear of missing out loses its grip. You no longer chase moments. You build a life. The world will keep moving loudly. Let it. You have learned something far more powerful than presence everywhere. Presence where it matters. 12. Learning to suffer in silence. Most people believe suffering becomes lighter when it is shared, but what they rarely notice is how quickly sharing turns into leaking. Complaints drain energy. Repeated explanations weaken resolve. Broadcasting pain turns endurance into performance. And slowly, without realizing it, the hardship itself becomes secondary to the attention it generates. This is not healing, it is dispersion. There is a difference between seeking wisdom and seeking relief, between asking for guidance and asking to be rescued. The modern reflex is to externalize discomfort immediately, to narrate it, post it, explain it, justify it, as if pain becomes unbearable the moment it is private. But what actually happens is more subtle and more damaging. Suffering loses its transformative power when it is constantly released outward. Solitude teaches a harder discipline. When you suffer alone, there is no audience to soothe you, no reaction to soften the weight, no validation to convert pain into identity. The discomfort remains fully yours, and because it cannot escape through complaint, it begins to do its work. This is where resilience is forged. Suffering endured quietly forces adaptation. It sharpens perception. It strengthens internal dialogue. You begin to ask not, why is this happening to me? But what does this require from me? The focus shifts from protest to response, from drama to discipline. Marcus Aurelius was uncompromising on this point. He did not romanticize pain, nor did he deny it. He simply insisted on clarity. If something is endurable, then endure it, without complaint, without self-pity, without unnecessary narration. Not because silence makes pain disappear, but because resistance wastes energy that endurance requires. Complaining feels relieving in the moment, but it weakens you over time. Each time you rehearse suffering aloud, you reinforce it mentally. Each time you retell the story, you relive it. Each time you seek sympathy, you train your nervous system to associate pain with attention rather than growth. Over time, hardship becomes something you need to express instead of something you learn to carry. Silence breaks this loop. When you suffer without an audience, you discover something most people never do. Pain does not expand when it is not fed. It peaks. It settles. It transforms. You become intimate with discomfort instead of terrified of it. You learn its limits. You learn your own. This does not mean isolation from help or wisdom. It means restraint from unnecessary exposure. There is strength in knowing when to speak, and even greater strength in knowing when not to. Some battles are weakened by commentary. Some wounds heal faster when untouched. Some burdens are meant to be carried privately, not because they are shameful, but because they are formative. A person who suffers loudly often remains fragile. A person who suffers quietly becomes dense. Their pain does not disappear. It consolidates. It becomes endurance. It becomes perspective. It becomes a silent confidence that does not need recognition to exist. They stop needing the world to acknowledge their struggle in order to continue. This changes how you move. You stop dramatizing obstacles. You stop rehearsing worst-case scenarios aloud. You stop turning hardship into identity. Instead, you develop a private toughness, the kind that does not announce itself, does not seek validation, and does not collapse under pressure. You learn that silence is not suppression, it is containment. And containment is what allows pressure to shape rather than shatter you. Solitude trains this daily. Every discomfort you endure without commentary, every setback you process internally before reacting, every moment you choose composure over expression, these are repetitions. Over time, emotional leakage stops, focus tightens, strength concentrates. This is not coldness, it is composure under load. The world will not always be fair. Pain will not always be optional, but suffering does not have to make you loud to make you strong. Learn to endure without spectacle. Learn to carry without complaint. Learn to suffer and remain sovereign. Because the most unbreakable spirit is not the one that feels nothing. It is the one that feels deeply and still moves forward in silence. 13. Stripping the persona. Most people believe they know who they are, but what they really know is the version of themselves that survives socially. The agreeable version, the acceptable version, the version that avoids friction, rejection, and judgment. Over time, this version hardens into a mask, not because it is authentic, but because it is rewarded. And the longer you wear it, the harder it becomes to remember what lies beneath. From early on, you learn that certain traits bring approval while others invite resistance. So you adjust. You soften where you are strong. You hide where you are intense. You exaggerate what is safe and silence what is dangerous. This adaptation feels practical at first, but slowly it becomes a prison. You begin living in character rather than in truth. Solitude is where this performance collapses. When you're alone, there's no role to maintain, no reaction to manage, no audience to calibrate yourself against. The social feedback loop disappears, and with it, the incentive to pretend. What remains is unfamiliar at first, quieter, rougher, less polished, but far more real. This is where discomfort arises. You begin noticing how much of your behavior was shaped by anticipation rather than intention. How often you said what was expected instead of what was true? How many of your choices were made to preserve an image rather than align with yourself? This realization can feel destabilizing because it forces a painful question. Who am I when I stop trying to be liked? Most people avoid this question indefinitely. They stay busy, they stay social, they stay surrounded, because solitude threatens the persona by removing the reward system that sustains it. Without applause, the mask loses purpose. Without reaction, it loosens. Arthur Schopenhauer understood this deeply. He observed that a person can be themselves only when alone, because only in solitude is freedom complete. Not freedom from rules, but freedom from performance. Freedom from the constant pressure to adjust, impress, and conform. Stripping the persona does not mean becoming antisocial or reckless. It means becoming congruent. In solitude, you begin to notice which traits return naturally when no one is watching. What interests persist without external reward. What values remain intact without reinforcement. What thoughts continue to arise, even when they are never spoken. This is the raw material of identity, unedited, unmarketed, and unprotected. This process is not comfortable. The persona was built for safety. Removing it exposes vulnerability, but it also restores honesty. You stop negotiating with yourself. You stop justifying contradictions. You stop living divided between who you are and who you pretend to be. Over time, a quiet alignment emerges. Your words begin to match your actions. Your choices stop needing explanation. Your presence feels grounded rather than performative. People may find you harder to read. Some may find you less accommodating. Others may drift away, sensing that the version of you they were comfortable with no longer exists. This is not loss, it is filtration. What remains is cleaner connection, rooted in who you are rather than who you perform. A person trapped in persona is exhausted. A person who has stripped it feels lighter, not because life is easier, but because they are no longer carrying a false self. They are no longer managing impressions. They are no longer editing their existence in real time. Their energy returns inward. And from there, it becomes usable. Solitude is the only place this stripping can occur honestly. In crowds, the mask is necessary. In silence, it is optional. And when you finally meet the self beneath the persona, not idealized, not polished, but real, you gain something far more valuable than approval. You gain freedom, freedom to think without performing. Freedom to choose without explaining, freedom to exist without negotiation. This is not loneliness, this is authenticity reclaimed. And once reclaimed, it cannot be taken from you again. 14. Intentional gatekeeping. Once you begin to build something real inside yourself, clarity, discipline, independence, inner order, a new danger appears, one that most people never anticipate. It is not attack, it is access. The world does not only test you by opposing you, it tests you by entering you, and without boundaries, everything you build will be slowly diluted. Most people lose themselves not through force, but through availability. They let everyone in, every demand, every emotional spillover, every opinion, every crisis that is not theirs to carry. They confuse openness with virtue and accessibility with kindness. And before they realize it, their energy is fragmented, their focus is broken, and their inner structure begins to soften. What they call generosity is often poor gatekeeping. Solitude teaches you the cost of access. When you have spent enough time alone to stabilize yourself, to regulate your emotions, to define your values, you begin to notice something clearly. Not everyone deserves proximity. Not everyone has earned your time. Not everyone who wants access to you has the capacity to respect what you are building. This realization feels uncomfortable at first because it contradicts a deeply ingrained belief that saying no makes you cold arrogant, or selfish. But boundaries are not cruelty. They are architecture. Without them, nothing stands. Confucius expressed this with precision when he warned against keeping company with those not equal to your standards. This was not about superiority, it was about alignment, about understanding that influence is constant, subtle, and cumulative. You do not need enemies to be weakened, you only need enough misaligned access. Intentional gatekeeping begins internally. You start by guarding your attention. You notice which conversations drain you and which sharpen you, which environments pull you backward and which demand your best, which people respect your silence and which punish you for it. Slowly you stop explaining your boundaries. You enforce them quietly. Then comes emotional gatekeeping. You stop absorbing other people's chaos as if it were your responsibility. You stop being the container for unresolved trauma that is never addressed. You stop mistaking emotional intensity for depth. This does not make you unkind. It makes you precise. Precision is strength. As your inner world stabilizes, access becomes a privilege rather than an assumption. You choose who enters your time, your space, your mind. You stop being endlessly reachable. You stop negotiating your peace. And in doing so, you protect the very thing most people lose, continuity. Because growth requires consistency. Consistency requires energy, and energy must be guarded. A person with no gates is constantly interrupted. Their direction is diluted by obligation. Their values are softened by proximity. They are pulled into dramas that have nothing to do with their path and wonder why progress feels slow. But a person who practices intentional gatekeeping moves differently. They are not loud about their boundaries. They are not hostile. They are simply unavailable to what does not align. This changes how people treat you. Some will drift away, offended by limits they once ignored. Others will adjust, recognizing that access now has conditions, and a few, the right few, will respect you more deeply because boundaries signal self-respect. Gatekeeping is not isolation, it is filtration. It ensures that what enters your life supports what you are becoming instead of eroding it. It allows relationships to exist without consumption. It protects solitude from being invaded by noise disguised as connection. Once you build value, you must protect it, not aggressively, not defensively, but deliberately. Because the strongest structures are not the ones that are open to everything. They are the ones that decide, calmly and clearly, what belongs inside. 15. The dangerous individual. At the end of this path, something subtle but irreversible happens. You no longer move through life trying to secure yourself. You no longer chase certainty, approval, or protection. Not because the world became safer, but because you did. And this is where you become dangerous, not in the sense of violence, but in the sense of independence that cannot be easily influenced, pressured, or controlled. Most people are predictable because they need something. They need reassurance. They need belonging. They need validation. They need comfort. And wherever there is need, there is leverage. Fear enters through dependency. Manipulation works through desire. Control is exercised through threat of loss. This is why most people, even intelligent ones, bend quietly when pressure appears. But the individual who has walked through solitude correctly arrives somewhere else entirely, after the validation detox, the biological reset, the confrontation with the shadow, the reclaiming of decision-making, emotional autonomy, value authorship, boredom tolerance, observation, inner fortification, independence, freedom from FOMO, silent endurance, and the stripping of the persona. Something essential dies, the need to be managed. You no longer require others to stabilize your inner world. You no longer depend on environments to behave correctly. You no longer collapse when attention is withdrawn or approval disappears. Your identity is no longer reactive. It is internally anchored. This is what makes you dangerous. Not loud, not aggressive, not confrontational, but ungovernable. Miyamoto Musashi understood this better than most when he said that nothing outside of you can make you stronger, wiser, or faster, because everything that matters is built within. He was not speaking mystically. He was describing a person who no longer leaks power outward. The dangerous individual does not rush. They do not beg. They do not explain unnecessarily. They choose when to engage and when to remain still. They can endure discomfort without panic. They can walk away without fear. They can stand alone without feeling diminished. Their calm is not passivity. It is containment. And this containment unsettles people. Because a person who needs nothing cannot be easily threatened. A person who fears nothing essential cannot be easily controlled. A person who is complete within themselves does not negotiate their worth. This does not make them cruel. It makes them clear. They can love without clinging. They can commit without dependence. They can lead without dominance. Their presence carries weight because it is not asking for permission to exist. Notice how rare this is. Most people build lives around avoidance, avoiding loneliness, avoiding boredom, avoiding discomfort, avoiding responsibility, avoiding silence. The dangerous individual does the opposite. They have walked through all of it deliberately. And because of that, none of it controls them anymore. They are not immune to pain. They are not detached from life. They are simply no longer fragile. This is the ultimate outcome of solitude done correctly. Not isolation, not bitterness, not superiority, but self-possession. You no longer need the world to confirm who you are. You no longer need constant movement to feel alive. You no longer need noise to escape yourself. You have met yourself fully, and you survived the meeting. And because of that, you move differently, calmer, slower, more precise. You choose your battles. You guard your energy. You allow very little inside and only what strengthens you. This is why the dangerous individual does not announce themselves. They do not threaten. They do not persuade. They do not perform. They simply are. And in a world built on dependency, distraction, and noise, that quiet independence is the rarest and most formidable power there is. Stay alone, not forever, but long enough to become this person. Because once you no longer need to be protected, nothing outside of you can ever truly harm you again. If you've stayed with this journey until now, then you already understand something most people never allow themselves to see. Solitude was never the enemy. What you feared was not being alone, but being unprepared to meet yourself without distractions, without validation, without escape. This path was never about isolation for its own sake. It was about stripping away everything that weakened you quietly. The addiction to approval, the dependency on stimulation, the fear of boredom, the outsourcing of emotion, the borrowed values, the lack of boundaries, the need to be everywhere, the habit of suffering loudly, the mask you wore to survive socially. None of these made you strong. They only made you busy. Solitude did what noise never could. It revealed, it corrected, it disciplined. You learned how to stand without applause, how to calm yourself without rescue, how to decide without consensus, how to endure without leaking energy, how to protect your inner world without hostility, how to miss out without fear, how to remove the mask and remain whole. And somewhere along the way, something fundamental shifted. You stopped needing to be managed. This is the moment where solitude ends. Not because you rush back into the world unchanged, but because you return with structure, with boundaries, with self-possession. You no longer enter relationships to be completed. You no longer seek noise to feel alive. You no longer tolerate chaos to avoid being alone. You choose. You engage with people from strength, not hunger. You move through life with intention, not reaction. You carry your center with you, wherever you go. The world will continue to reward dependency, distraction, and constant availability. Let it. You've learned something rarer, how to be sufficient. And sufficiency is freedom. So don't fear silence anymore. Don't rush to fill emptiness. Don't trade your calm for belonging. Stay alone when you need to. Return when you choose to. Because once you have mastered yourself, solitude is no longer a refuge. It is a source. And from that source, you can build a life that does not collapse when the world looks away. If this journey resonated with you, don't just listen, commit. Write in the comments, "I don't fear solitude anymore." Not for me, for yourself.